Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon to all. I'm very impressed. The World Cup is about to start, and we still have a fairly full room here. Very warm welcome to everybody. We're in the middle of my name is Olav Kjørven. I'm a special advisor to UNDP's administrator on the post-2015 development agenda. We're in the middle of an extraordinary process. For the first time in human history, the governments of this world are trying to agree on a set of key priorities, key objectives for the whole world when it comes to sustainable development and meeting the challenge of eradicating poverty and creating a better world, and at the same time safeguarding our planet. And this is happening also with unprecedented input and engagement by people from all over the world. And close to 3 million people have actually given their voice and let us know what their views are, what sort of world do they want to live in. But all of this has been predominantly about the what. What should that agenda look like? What should be the goals and targets? Increasingly, there's a parallel discussion on the how. If we can agree on the what, how do we implement it so it actually works? Right now, we have some 50 national dialogues underway to explore the how. But what about the why? Why are we doing all this work? Perhaps some will say it's because of decisions made in Rio, simple as that. Or because of the success of the MDGs. We want to do it again, but do an even better job. Because we're facing some major challenges. Or because of particular interests. Or because it's our job. But I think that behind all of that, all of us, I think we all know that we're involved in all of this for reasons that go a lot deeper. There is some kind of flame that burns inside us, a set of values that compel us to get up in the morning and make a real effort. Or conversely, if and when we forget about that flame or these values or lose sight of them, we may also lose sight of what we're actually trying to achieve, what is truly worthwhile. And we may settle for less than what the global situation actually demands. At the essence of a universal sustainable development agenda, it's all about partnership. Partnerships around some serious problem solving. And it's about trust. Trust that everyone will do their part, whether governments, local authorities, business, civil society. And that requires some common denominators, some common drivers, reasons to combine forces and to trust. And for that, we have a lot to draw from. We have the different faith traditions. We have different philosophical schools of thought. We have the precious human rights that are the bedrock of the United Nations. But we rarely talk about this why. And yet, right now, it may be the most important question to ask, because coming to an ambitious agreement across all the interests that are represented in the UN membership, it's a very, very difficult thing to do. It's a very hard thing to achieve. And you need some very powerful whys to do that, to overcome our differences. So that is why we're having this event. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce you now to a remarkable panel of leaders. We have with us Her Excellency Mary Elizabeth Flores, Permanent Representative of Honduras to the United Nations. We have with us in the hall here, Mr. Karma Chueda, Counselor of the Permanent Mission of the Kingdom of Bhutan to the United Nations. I should also say that Bhutan and Honduras and Sweden have joined us in supporting and sponsoring this event. Unfortunately, the Swedish ambassador had to run to other meetings this afternoon, so he's not here with us, but Sweden is also fully supportive of our event. We have with us our own Amina Mohammed, the Special Advisor to the Secretary General on the post-2015 development agenda. We have with us His Excellency Monsignor Marcelo Sanchez Sorondo, the Chancellor of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences and the Pontifical Academy of Social Science, and a especially warm welcome to you, and thank you so much for coming to join us today. We have with us on the phone Dr. Virabhadran Ramanathan, Director of the Center for Atmospheric Sciences, Scripps Institution of Oceanography, I can hardly say that word, sorry, University of California. Now, he was supposed to be here too, but he's had an accident and suffered from a concussion, so he will instead speak to us on the phone. But thank you so much for your willingness to do that, Mr. Ramanathan. I know he's hearing us. And we have with us Dr. Bill Bendley, Secretary General of Religions for Peace International, and thank you so much for being with us. And last but not least, Professor Jeffrey Sachs, Director of the Sustainable Development Solutions Network and Special Advisor to the Secretary General on the MDGs. And without any further ado, I'm now very pleased to give the floor to Ambassador Flores, please.
Excellencies, colleagues, panelists, and distinguished guests, good afternoon. On behalf of Honduras, I thank you for responding to this global call to rectify and reshape the world in the next decades. The MDGs were a transformational initiative that brought awareness on the pace of development and remain in the heart of the potential post-2015 agenda. The questions are many. How to continue and build on the obtained achievements? How to support and partner with countries that are lagging behind to move them forward and be prepared to commit to the possible sustainable development goals plan of action. As member states negotiating a universal framework, we must do our best and complete work to reflect the rights and the aspirations of our peoples and the world's population at large. To own and to commit to this end, to assure its success, to attain more equitable and fair societies, all under a roof of transparency, responsibility, and accountability. Honduras and the global community cannot talk about achieving sustainable development without reflecting on the person. We have to think about and take action in terms of the most poor and marginalized. A case in point is a woman by the name of Maria Soledad, who lives in a small shack of an impoverished village in my country, where there is no electricity or the basic needs to live. She walks every day for more than an hour to the river to wash her clothes and fetch water for cooking. Her children are barefoot and suffer from malnutrition. What will the SDG agenda do for Maria and her children and for the millions of Marias around the world and their families? We can no longer sit back and contemplate present and intergenerational responsibilities. Sustainable development is a reality, and we have all agreed to this reality. We, as a global community, ought to create a level of workability and partnership out of the possibilities being carved out to generate unprecedented opportunities. Dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, our time is now. Let's create, take action, and stand together in pursuit of a sustainable and fulfilled future. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ambassador, for those powerful opening words. We now give the floor to Mr. Karma Chueda, Councillor of Bhutan. Please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. At the outset, I wish to convey my ambassador's apologies for not being here today owing to other prior commitments. But I'm greatly honored to represent my country and wish to start by commending UNDP and Sustainable Development Solutions Network for organizing this important side event that seeks to address the critical link between values and sustainable development goals. Bhutan is pleased to be a part of this event, and I thank you for giving us the opportunity to address this gathering. The convening of this site event is timely, as the OWG is currently engaged in considering a draft set of SDGs. With only two more sessions for the OWG to complete its work, this site event provides an opportune moment to reflect on the kind of values that should inspire us in crafting a transformative and meaningful set of SDGs. In this regard, I find it relevant and appropriate to share some personal insights and thoughts of His Majesty the King of Bhutan, particularly on the themes of universal values and the concept of a shared planet. Speaking at a lecture a few years ago on the topic of changing world in timeless values, His Majesty said, and I quote, "You must break everything down to its fundamentals. Break it down to basic human instances. For in the end, no matter what country we may be from, we are human beings. No matter what our cultures and beliefs may be, we share the same needs and abide by the same fundamental values. In fact, it may be these very values that could guide us through the great problems, even those of environmental degradation, terrorism, and world poverty. Perhaps the first of these values is the sense of a shared planet. This is a world that is shared, not between governments and nations, but among us, the people. It may sound idealistic, but this is a natural and practical way of approaching things that seem intractable and inflexible, no matter how big the problem. The image of a shared planet must always be present in our minds, and especially in the minds of those who are in positions of leadership. Individual or even national success is a ship that cannot carry everyone together to the same place at the same time. Rich nations must stop to be mindful of the poorer ones left behind. Successful people must stop to remember those who didn't make it. No nation today can stand alone in achievement. Time is slowly but surely telling us that there can be no lasting individual success without success as a community, and there cannot be lasting national progress if it does not fit into a future of global peace, harmony, and equality. The world must progress together or fail together." End of quote. Ultimately, how each one of us thinks and acts, in other words, the values that drive us, or what we care about, determine the collective fate of a future development agenda. The challenge as we move forward, it seems to me, is that eventually we must rise above our narrow interests and compulsions and assume the role of the global citizen. The narrative of only caring about me, my family, my country, and my region must yield to that of caring about we, us, our world, our planet, and our shared future. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that wonderful statement. I now have the distinct pleasure of introducing my dear friend Amina. Amina has been living the value of courage, both on the front lines of making the Millennium Development Goals happen in her own country, and now in helping the global community forge the next set of goals. So, Amina, please.
Thank you very much, Olaf, and I'd also like to add my appreciation to the organizers for having us share why really we should care. And this is often something that's forgotten in the corridors, as Olaf says, the war front of crossing T's and dotting I's and negotiating and just about words, and sometimes forgetting why it is that we are here to do what we're supposed to do. I think the most exciting thing that came out of Rio was, albeit full of challenges, was that member states took ownership and decided to lead on the process for developing the next development agenda. and that we would move from just looking at it from the basis of poverty to sustainable development, really think through people and planet. However, as 2.5 years later, as the rubber begins to hit the road and we have to come up against a set of priorities that we must define over the next year or so, this is when the tough and sometimes you'd say makes no sense question of why we should be doing this needs to arise. Because in some cases, some of those priorities, you'd say, of course, we're going to choose to better the lives of children and to ensure that women don't die in childbirth. But that's not always the case. And so against the backdrop of what is existing challenges, and that means that we have to really look to see how we finish off the MDGs, but the emerging ones that are happening, and every day, certainly in the halls of the United Nations, we see the burden and the tragedies of conflict. So I think that as I speak to why one should care, I think the saddest picture that we have to try to change is one that I can best describe by quoting what the Pope had to say, which is when he looked at the greatest challenges of the world today being that one of global indifference. And I think that global indifference is perhaps the greatest challenge of why we need to reiterate over and over again why we should care. And I would say to this 3 or 4 things. Because we should never have an environment in which 200 girls in my country are kidnapped and used as the spoils of war. This should never be the case. We should never have a sense that a woman goes into hospital to deliver and won't come out. So the woman should not die in childbirth. We shouldn't have children who are, in a sense, condemned to a life imprisoned within their brains that have been stunted because they haven't had a chance to have a nutritious meal or meals or fed in the way in which they should be. Because an island called Nauru in the Pacific that we don't see because it's so far off the coast of Australia with 10,000 people has a population of over 90% with diabetes type A. That shouldn't happen in the world today. And because young people have the right to economic inclusion and not exclusion, and therefore, if we had them included, we wouldn't provide the fodder for the instability and extremism that we find around the world. We would, in fact, see that we would be in a better world. And personally, I'd like to say that for me, impacts where I come from. We have the terrorist group called Boko Haram today. These young people actually grew up and went to school where I went to school. I went to school in Maiduguri. I had a primary education there. But I had everything that was in place to give us an education and an opportunity to sit in the halls of the United Nations and contribute to shaping the next development agenda. These young people had absolutely nothing. They were excluded. There was injustice. And at the end of the day, they lost their dignity and had nothing to lose. And that's something that should never be the future of a young person born today thinking of their future ahead. So I think that it is the reason why we should care is because it is the right thing to do, and I know we talk about the rights because it is one of the pillars that holds up the United Nations, but it is the right thing to do, and it certainly is a moral imperative for post-2015 and the development agenda ahead, lest we lose that common humanity that I believe we all stand for. Thank you.
Thank you, Amina, for that. It's now my distinct pleasure to give the floor to His Excellency Marcelo Sanchez Sorondo. And I should mention that the bishop has a long set of publications in the sciences, has been awarded a PhD in sacred theology, and has been full professor of history of philosophy at Libera Università Maria. In Rome. I'm not sure if I got the name right there. But please, Bishop, warm welcome, and you have the floor.
Thank you.
Just once. No.
Thank you. And thank you for the invitation. And thank you, especially to my friend, Jeffrey Sachs, that I really consider a good guy for this global war and this moment. And sorry for my professional deformation. I am bishop, but I am also professor of philosophy, and if when I speak, I put some categories of philosophy. Sorry. But I think that we need to come back to the great questions to the great question in our society to have a real new and old hierarchy of values. It's clear that today we have GDP very high in many societies, and in the world maybe we have the more great quantity of goods, but we don't have the great and old question of the happiness. We don't have the people happy, and this is the real question. You know that Aristotle in his Ethic and in his Polit tried to achieve what is the happiness, that is the thing that all human beings naturally desire. And in this world market, at this by rapid urbanization, increases mass communication, global capitalism, and environment decay, we need to come back to this question. And not in the modern and Kantian sense, we can say, that is to say, what is the thing that I need to do, we say technically, deontologically, but in the sense more deeply, what are real the social values that give to the society this happiness that all people find? And of course, Aristotle confirmed that the social values, such as justice and equity, belong to the question of the happiness. In the beginning of his many different books about ethics, the goal of happiness is not a perfection that we can have in solitude, both in the consideration of the individual person, but also in the consideration of the individual nations. We have this in the context of the city, of the polis, and in the global city, we can say today, social values and are the all people find, and to have happiness, we need to consider the end of the common goods and the structure of the society. What we need to know is how to reorganize our social and economic life in the global city in order to spread the values of contemplation, prayer, community, equity, fraternity, trust, and environment sustainably that create real happiness. And I propose an agenda for happiness today that, of course, is a provisional agenda and improbable that we can perfection. But in the more important consideration, we can have the horizon is aim for the truth life with and for others within the framework of just institutions. The first things we should not be light the value of the material goods and the production of consumer goods and economic progress, nor the value of banks and financial institutions that operate for the benefits of society and not for their own institutional advantage. Human beings who are deprived of their daily bread also lack basic necessities such as drinking water, health care, education, and equal opportunities is not work. Without a job to support themselves, men and women inevitably suffer, and in many cases saying they suffer to death. And this is not a metaphor, as say the Pope Francis in his document Evangelium Gaudi. as Paul VI wrote in Populorum Progressio, sustainable, as we say today, economic development promoted by good individuals and just institutions that mitigate everyone's poverty is an irreplaceable value and, at the same time, in general, a vital goal on the path towards happiness and social peace. The Romans say, homo sine pecunia imago mortis. That is to say, the people do not have money is like the dead. And Pius the 11 intelligent remarked that you cannot preach virtue to the people that have their stomachs impaired with nothing. And this is the first thing. The second thing focuses only to the GDP, to the point of excluding any other goal in itself, prevent us from achieving happiness. We need both macroeconomy and microeconomy to work, which means pursuing the common good in general and the concrete different common goods that are the ingredients of the good life for each person and not just for a group or social class. Today, there are many countries that have a very good GDP, but don't have happiness. And there are many people in these countries that suicide his life. And for this, we need to reconsider the scale and the hierarchy of the values. Three, the happiness of individuals and society is achieved through an approach to life that is capable of reestablishing a healthy hierarchy of values. Every effort in this sense must be based on the individual and social virtues of truth, freedom, justice, the preeminence of the common good over selfish and specific interests, and on fraternity and especially charity, which is the mother of all the virtues, we say. 50 years ago, John the 23 proposed these virtues to all men and women of goodwill in his important encyclical Pacem in Terris after a child peace between United States and the Soviet Union in the question of Cuban War, thus preventing a nuclear war. As human beings with a body and a soul, equipped with intelligence and freedom in our choice of values, we are unhappy if our basic material needs are denied. But we are even unhappy if the pursuit of every high levels of income takes priority over all moments of prayer, quiet time, family time, vocational and professional responsibilities, friends, communities, fraternities. It is one thing to establish economical policy at natural and global level, to constantly improve standards of living, to develop of other person dimension. It is another thing to subordinate all the society values to this profit. Nevertheless, in general, and as far as we know, emerging Western and Eastern policies are increasingly helping corporate and financial interests to overshadow all other aspirations, truth, honesty, trust, fraternity, generosity, mental and physical health, and environment sustainability. I don't want to speak about other countries, but I know that many European countries that I live today have this problem. This rise of inequality and the laws against human dignity are the result of vicious circle. The so-called wealthy, the 1% use its assets to red tape legislation in order to protect and increase its fortune and influence, and not to the good of the other people. Four, between a person's skills and their implementation lists the mediation role of the other. This is a very important question. If we don't consider the other, and the other in his develop, as I think one of the more important economists and sociologists, Amartya Sen, say, we need to understand the human rights in the line of the capability of each person. And the capability of a person is not only the person that are agents, but also the person to suffer, and especially the person to suffer. And there are many forms of suffering. There are the suffering of physical, but there are a suffering of moral and mental pain. But the reeducation in any event of destruction of the ability to act and being able to do these things. For these things, I think the ethic of responsibility to develop the values in the person is very important to put together with the question of the human rights. And we come back in this sense to the classic notion of virtue that in the Greeks basically means excellence in action that make a good, happy life possible. Five, a certain type of global capitalism which tend to prevail, and this is the question in relation with nature, follow the idea for example, the philosophy of Nietzsche, will to power, and consider the nature like a material plastic that we can do anything with the nature, we need to understand that the nature have its laws, and we need to respect these laws that are in the nature. In the contrary, we have, as saved Pope Francis, we destroyed the nature, but the nature destroys us. And we have the mad cold, and we have the climate change, and we have the global warming, and all these things are the consequence of our consideration of nature not as a real habitat of us with his laws, but only as material that we can use for our profit and not more. And this is also the consequence of our recent meeting about the sustainability of nature. And we can finish, and maybe we can add more things in a discussion, but we can also observe that many industry only have the interest of profit and not do nothing really to the good of the person, and we need to put the person in the center of this consideration of the new scale of values. And in the end, we need to put the social inclusion, that the first question, together with the question of nature, and we are also want to finish with a consideration of the importance of religions, because in the end, the formation of the values, if we have an historical approach, come from the great religions, and we can consider that all the cultures are an sort of soul, and this soul is the religion. And for this, we need to come back to consider the importance of the religion. I speak with my religion, but there are other religions also that we have in dialogue to defend the problem of the humanity, especially with the idea of Pope Francis that say, we don't want to defend our institution, our religion, only to have an opposition in defense, but we need to put the religion, especially our religion, but also the other religion I have for the other leader of religion that are more or less in the same line, to save the people. And when I was in the seminar, there was a very interesting book of one of the theologians of the Council Vatican II that was the name Congar. And he put a book to say we need to change the church to become poor in a service to the people. And this is the idea of the Pope Francis. We want to have a poor church to service of the people and the problem of the people. Concretely, he asked to study the problem of human trafficking, the problem of the morality, the problem of the soul of the organs in the children, and the problem of the social exclusion. And for this reason, I think that come back to the great values that are produced in our history in all the parts of the world, we need to come back to this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bishop, for those powerful words. You mentioned the Vatican meeting just a couple of months ago on sustainable humanity, sustainable nature. And one of the co-organizers for that was precisely Dr. Ramanathan, who is now with us on the phone and will speak to us. And I have to confess that while you spoke, I practiced how to pronounce oceanography. That's better, right? And indeed, Mr. Ramanathan is a distinguished professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, University of California, San Diego. And Dr. Ramanathan, you're with us?
Can you hear me, Mr. Kirwan?
We can hear you perfectly. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. I also want to thank Professor Jeffrey Sachs for the invitation. I have worked on the climate change and air pollution problems for nearly four decades, and I've had the misfortune of seeing my dire predictions come true time and again, but sadly, the real-world outcomes were far worse than what we had predicted. So just to set the stage, let me start with my most recent prediction, which made in 2008, which was we have already added enough warming pollutants to heat the planet to an unprecedented 2 degrees by 2050, just in the next 35, 40 years. And of course, with devastating impacts on heat waves, droughts, floods, and sea level rise. So the question is, why do I care? The worst affected from these changes will be the 3 billion people living mostly in rural areas who had very little to do with this warming pollution. So as society, we have left these 3 billion behind with minimal access to modern forms of energy. And so as another speaker pointed out, they still burn firewood for cooking and have unreliable access to energy and to water. So compare that with the other extreme, about 1 billion are mostly responsible for this energy consumption, which led to this increase in the carbon dioxide gas that warmed the planet. I'm going to call this carbon pollution. Well, that's the problem. There's also that's where the solution is. The top 1 billion energy consumers need to drastically cut their carbon pollution. And the cost of this has been estimated by UN's IPCC to be about $500 billion a year, or only about $500 per person amongst the top 1 billion. So in addition, this top 1 billion need to provide or enable clean energy access to the bottom 3 billion, and the cost of that also has been estimated to be about $95 billion a year, are only about $95 per person among the top 1 billion. So basically, we are talking about an expense of just $590 per person amongst the top 1 billion energy consumers to solve two of the biggest issues facing the planet, climate change and providing energy access for the bottom 3 billion. So let me continue with the energy access issue. We need to provide them clean energy for cooking, lighting, and equally importantly, pumping water for drinking and irrigation. So we can ask, what do we, as the top 1 billion, stand to gain? In about a few decades, without renewable energy access, the fossil fuel consumption by the bottom 3 billion will become large enough to be a major source for global warming. So we, the top 1 billion, for our own preservation, need to provide clean energy access with renewables for this bottom 3 billion. And the cost of that is only $95 per person per year. And I'm not talking about giving away this energy for free. It requires grassroots, bottom-up approaches. And I want to give you an example of a project we started. It's called Project Surya. It provides clean cook stoves and solar lighting to villagers and uses cell phones to monitor their usage and provide carbon credits directly to women using these technologies. So we are connecting women in villages to voluntary carbon markets, and it's the top 1 billion which subscribe to this carbon market. So let's ask, what happens if you replace all of the smoky cook stoves used by the bottom 3 billion people? We will avoid 4 million deaths amongst women and children every year from the cook stove pollution. We will mitigate climate change by reducing carbon pollution by 1 billion tons and reduce other climate warming pollutants by as much as 3 billion tons. So we not only address poverty-related issues, but also climate mitigation. So in this project, we are focusing on black carbon, a major global warming pollutant. But there are three other such climate warming pollutants and which have ready-made solutions. These are methane, ozone, and hydrofluorocarbons used as refrigerants. We have technologies in hand. And fortunately, they require just sub-national collaborations. And we can drastically cut these pollutants. And in so doing, we will reduce the warming trend in the next 20, 30 years by 50%. So the climate change problem is still solvable. And I want to give you another major example. This is close to Pope Francis's heart. About a third of the produced food is wasted. And like Pope Francis said, this wasted food is like taking food away from the poor. But by drastically cutting this food waste and providing it to the poor, we can also avoid 3 billion tons of carbon pollution every year we put to the air. So instead of in closing, the problem is solvable. And by focusing on this two-worlds approach, the top 1 billion energy emitters, energy consumers, and the bottom 3 billion with no energy access, we can really bring in grassroots, bottom-up approaches to help the top-down approach from the United Nations. So you saw in my example how by taking steps to mitigate climate change at a cost of just $590 per person amongst the top 1 billion consumers, we also address fundamental issues of poverty, energy access, and women's well-being. I want to conclude by saying the issue of climate change and energy access has become a moral issue. And I'm delighted. We have religious leaders today, and Pope Francis is one of the best examples, who have the moral authority to ask people to change their behavior. And I just want to point out in this regard, a month ago, thanks to the Vatican and Chancellor Sorando, we convened this sustainability meeting. And it led to a declaration, and Professor Sachs was participant of this. And in our declaration, we, of course, called for better stewardship of the planet, which Pope Francis then supported. But we also issue a strong statement of support for pursuing this sustainable development goal. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Dr. Ramanathan. And we wish you speedy recovery. Didn't sound like you had suffered too much from that concussion. That was very clear. And I think everyone in this room heard you very loudly and clearly in more than one sense of the word. And I have the distinct pleasure of giving the floor to Bill Vendley, Secretary General of Religions for Peace International, and member of its World Council, which consists of 60 senior religious leaders from all continents. And Dr. Vendley is also an advisor to the U.S. President Barack Obama through his service on the Multi-Religious Cooperation and International Affairs Task Force of the White House. It's a distinct honor to have you here with us.
Thank you very much indeed, and I'm so pleased to be here. I thank the co-organizers, the missions of Honduras, Sweden, Bhutan, UNDP, and the Sustainable Development Solutions Network. I'm particularly taken, Olaf, by your framing in your opening remarks. What should be done is being deeply debated, examined, even in two different tracks. How should it be done? But you've gathered us here around a question, why should it be done? And I think that's very fitting and very complementary to the first two tracks. I'm happy that I have had the privilege to work with religious leaders in more than 90 countries where Religions for Peace has interreligious councils. And from as early as 1970, there has been a solid multi-religious consensus in Religions for Peace that peace is more than the absence of war. Peace is profoundly positive. This is the view of the world's religions, and it includes a comprehensive notion of human flourishing, the heart of which is a truly holistic notion of development that honors human dignity. Again, honoring human dignity is positive. It's not simply defending human dignity. It means, at least for the consensus of these religious traditions, advancing the development of human beings on all levels, physical, vital levels, intellectual, affective, artistic, moral, and yes, for religious people, on the religious level as well. This multi-religious consensus acknowledges the unity of the human family, the human race. So it drives by its own inner force to a comprehensive sense of moral caring, a caring that obtains far beyond oneself, one's family, one's group, one's nation, or one's religion. This comprehensive caring is rooted in each religion in its own particular way. So although I speak about a consensus, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Jainism, Sikhism, Zoroastrianism, Baha'ism, indigenous religions, and others remain faithful to their own particular beliefs and yet affirm simultaneously their moral consensus on an obligation to support a holistic notion of human development. Simply stated, the religious communities are convinced together that there is an obligation to proactively commit, as a believer, to help the other to develop and unfold his or her human dignity in a genuine and holistic notion of development. In fact, this commitment to help the other is seen as a mark of authentic development. Not to be committed to that is seen as a failure to rise to what it really means to be a human being committed to one's own particular religious beliefs. There's further the commitment that each of us is obliged to develop ourselves and the full swath of what it would mean to be a human being, including our moral stature as people, and for religious people, their own understandings of their own religious development. So let me try to put just a little more moral meat on this bone. Morals are a double-edged sword. That sword doesn't cut one way. It cuts in multiple directions. And in this light, we can perhaps all agree that the lack of development, especially the scandal of extreme poverty, is a double menace. First, it chokes, thwarts, wastes, and humiliates the human dignity of those caught in the extreme poverty trap. They are clearly its first victims. But second, it's a kind of moral cancer on all the rest of us, persons, civic organizations, businesses, governments, who by some feat of intellectual and moral rationalization, some feat of culpable ignorance and truncated will, decide not to do the doable to relieve the crushing weight of extreme poverty. So it cuts two ways. We cannot underestimate the insidious damage of rationalizing or of culpably refusing to decide to do what can be done to advance development. Let me focus on it one more small step. Every decision, as we know, embodies a value. So everybody has values insofar as everybody decides this over that. Every choice is a decision about what is worthwhile. Values are about what one deems worthwhile. One scale of values is about what one deems to be more worthwhile than something else. Let me illustrate with a success story and one that comes back here to the United Nations, for which we can all be deeply proud. 50 years ago, over 50 million children perished every year from childhood diseases, and now that figure has come down to approximately 6.6 million children a year. Still too high, but really extraordinary progress. As James Grant, the former director of UNICEF, used to repeat tirelessly, and he repeated it to me in many times, it's one thing to lose a child to an illness that has no cure. This is surely a tragedy, and it brings us great grief. It is another to lose a child to an illness that can be relatively easily and cheaply prevented. Then we hold our heads down in shame. This is not a tragedy. It is a travesty. Why? Because we know it shows a shameful, ultimately self-contradictory value choice. Instead of the little to save the child, investing the little to save the child is not seen as worthwhile compared to some other choice that de facto is valued more highly. Gently but firmly, woe to all of us when we so injure ourselves as to lose one among us like that. Secondly, I'd like to suggest that the basis for development is community, and I echo the quotation that you read from the ambassador of Bhutan making that same point. Community means fellow feelings, shared meanings and values, and a shared commitment to work for the common good. Community is the basic underpinning for all of the institutions that are to serve the common good. Families, schools, town institutions, countries, and their governments, and notably the United Nations here. These social institutions cannot function and in the limit cannot survive without a large measure of community. Take, for example, our respective governments. Even if there are good leaders, good policies, and even sufficient resources, without a healthy society rooted in genuine community, there is little likelihood of that setup serving the common good. Resources can be scarce, adequate, or lavish, but without a heavy, healthy measure of community, they cannot easily and efficiently be deployed for the common good. So if that's true, if community is at the basis of all of our institutions, including our ability to develop, we have to ask ourselves, what are the enemies of community, the enemies of what would be the basis for our ability to collaborate and act together? These are, in a way, the profound enemies of development, and they lie, so to speak, beneath the technical problems or challenges of development itself. And they're going to sound strange, maybe, to raise them here. They're ones we've heard as children, and yet they're still relevant. Three big ones: ignorance, individual egoism, or we could say individual selfishness, and group egoism. Very understandably, and this again, Olaf, we thank you, this is not to be confused with the struggle that either of the current tracks are working so hard to advance the post-2015 Sustainable Development Agenda. Those categories and those goals need to be objectively brought to bear in terms of the reality at hand. I'm speaking about another more basic set of categories that, if you will, lie behind the ability of us to work as states together, as organizations together, as religions together, as people together, to tackle a good agenda. Ignorance, I think we know, is the threat to community when whole groups of people are marginalized, denied access to the educations they need to function in society. They are effectively sidelined, stunted, thwarted, and thereby barred from entering into the mainstream. But ignorance is also a threat when we collectively refuse to analyze what is thwarting development, as well as the drivers for genuine development. Individual egoism, I'm really speaking about the very big challenge of becoming a moral self, is a threat to community because egoists find loopholes in the social setup, and they exploit these loopholes to enlarge their share of particular goods. They're, relatively speaking, takers, not givers. To the extent that a person contributes to a healthy society, he or she should be fairly remunerated. To the extent that a person has figured out and used loopholes on how to avoid his or her debts to society, they're exploiting the genuine community. And it's a moral issue, but I would argue it's at the heart, ultimately, of development. Worse, it's not just individuals who are self-centered, selfish. Groups and groups in institutions are prone, as we know, to this. They know how to work the system. They find ways to justify taking unfair advantages for themselves. They exaggerate their importance. They develop an ideological facade that would justify their ways before the bar of public opinion. If they succeed in their deception, the social process is distorted, community is eroded or mutilated, group egoisms call forth resentments, so the body social begins to seethe, at least under the surface, with hostility. Trust is lost, cynicism sets in. Now, where to go with that? I'm not trying to be depressive as we think about this extraordinary opportunity that we have. I come to my third point, and it's an answer to the former, the just previous and somewhat challenging observation, and it's the role of virtues for development. And it may seem an odd choice, but some of us, including some at this table, are convinced that these two are truly linked. the fundamental response to the pernicious factors, ignorance, personal egoism, group egoism, that erodes the community base for advancing development, I think lies in the cultivation of virtues. Does anyone really think we can have a holistic development without virtuous people? In fact, aren't virtuous people, in fact, a high water mark achievement of what a genuine development would mean? Virtues are, I recall with you, are habits, and they differ from skills. So skills too are habits, but virtues are habits that differ from skills in that they intend habitual orientations to value. Virtues include honesty, intellectual curiosity, love of learning, love of justice, kindness, tolerance, love, compassion, mercy. The acquisition of virtue does more than bring degrees of perfection to individual persons. When widely shared, virtues knit the fabric of social cohesion. They cohere in what might be called social trust, a word that I was describing earlier as community, which is even more basic than a social contract such as citizenship. Without virtuous people, even materially prosperous societies dig their own graves. They work at cross purposes. They mutilate social trust. They distort their respective scales of value, prizing selfish gains at the expense of the sacrifice essential for building a culture of holistic development. I would argue that the religions have been the original great schools of virtue. There are other ways to cultivate virtues, and I would celebrate those as well. Each religion, other school, has its own table or hierarchy of virtues. Each religion has its own teachings, stories, models, exemplars of virtue, the latter to be emulated, lifted up as models to be followed. Today, the question to the diverse religious communities is, what gifts of virtue does your community have to share to help all of us build the sense of community essential to advancing holistic development? Asked that way, religious communities are approaching each other across their differences with increasing trust and even gratitude for the concrete partnerships to build the common good. Today, the question to the nation states cannot be reduced to our growing and important technical abilities. There remains the question of value, of what's deemed worthwhile. A sense of community among states is essential for their collaboration, just as much as it is essential for any society. You, and I speak, Mr. Ambassador, right before us here, I speak to you and your colleagues as representatives of the states. You are shouldering the practical question of what shall the international community choose as a value, as worthwhile. And you have in your shouldering those burdens, I believe, the support of your own citizens, so many of whom themselves are in the great schools of virtue, the various religious communities. We know that this juncture is not easy, but its importance is not to be overestimated by any means. You have our support, and we believe that you can manage the complex trade-offs, which are trade-offs in terms of how people are esteeming or estimating values, and that you will manage this without forfeiting the common good. You can, I also believe, count on the religious communities and the men and women around the world. We're seized in this struggle together. So thank you.
Thank you, Bill, for that. Jeffrey Sachs doesn't need any introduction. We all know him well. And I can say that this meeting would never have happened without your strong engagement and support and direct action, both you personally as well as your good colleagues in the SDSN network and the Earth Institute, including Joanna, who's sitting right there. And it's been a great pleasure to partner with you for this event. Thank you very much, and you have the floor.
Allah, thank you very much. Well, this event has done all that I have hoped for, to hear these powerful, wonderful statements that have been made. And they do remind us of how puzzling all of this is. We're here to remind ourselves why it's important to save millions of children, or why it's important to save the future of the planet. One wouldn't think we would need to do that. So it is a little bit of a paradox. You would think that this would be not only self-evident, but understood widely, if not universally, to be the most compelling question on the planet and the most wonderful opportunity for each of us to express our humanity by joining in this effort. So everything about this is somewhat paradoxical, this question. We're talking about no small matters here, and the Sustainable Development Goals are no small matters either. They are, in my view, the best hope, and indeed the only clear hope we have to grasp something that is universal and that is compelling to allow us to change course right now. I think what Dr. Ramanathan put before us was very, very clear, and I know that he could go on telling us scientifically how extraordinary this moment is. And this is, in a sense, what makes our indifference not only so paradoxical, but also so profoundly troubling at this moment. In a way, we know from history, we know from Jesus's teachings, we know from every period of history that the need to wake up the moral spirit is always a pressing reality. Humanity is able to forget important things. It seems to be part of our very nature also, that capacity for indifference. But what is different today that makes the indifference so shocking is how dangerously close we are to profound consequences. I always refer back to a statement of this unique moment to what President Kennedy said a half century ago when he observed presciently in his inaugural address that we hold in our moral hands the ability to end all forms of human poverty and all forms of human life. That's a shocking truth. That truth has been with us since August 1945 in the nuclear age. And it's a truth that has been dramatically reinforced not only by the nuclear threat, but by the environmental threat. We're 42 years since we were first warned clearly about that threat when the world met in Stockholm in 1972 and was alerted clearly that we had already reached a scale of economic activity and population that was pushing the planet into a dangerous, new, and unprecedented physical reality. We've ignored that message for 42 years, really until today. Now we're roughly twice the population we were then. Economic output per person has continued to double every generation. The size of the human activity in the way that Dr. Ramanathan just reminded us in terms of the carbon pollution terms of the destruction of habitat, deforestation, loss of fresh water, and what now are more generally called the planetary boundaries, has brought us right to the limits of bare safety for our planet. And what's amazing about this moment is that we're at the height of our scientific and technological excellence in order to be able to address such matters. And so fundamentally, all of these questions are not matters of economics. They're not matters of technology. They're not even matters of politics. Fundamentally, it is a moral question. Fundamentally, it's a basic question of our own humanity and our capacity to face this reality of our time. I am absolutely, of course, I'm incredibly honored any moment I get to be next to Bishop Marcelo Sanchez Sorondo, because you heard his genius a few moments ago. And I would also share the same sentiment with William Venley. And what thrills me also is we have launched also today sustainable virtues, not only sustainable development goals, thanks to Bill, but one of the sustainable ideas that is permeating our discussion is the sustainability of Aristotle's ideas of 2,300 years ago, because they remain among the most compelling parts of our humanity till today. And I just want to point out, when Aristotle thought about what is a good life, his very first clearest statement, which we find compelling 2,300 years later, is man is a social animal. The fundamental truth of our virtue, our values, our path to humanity is that we are social. And what Aristotle said is the only way to be happy is for us to learn how to be good social animals. In other words, to be part of society. And he forever made us understand that it's not our commodities, it's not our income, it is our capacity to be part of humanity that is the essential path to our own well-being. And essentially, that path is the path of virtue that Bill Venley described, because that's how Aristotle put it. Virtue is excellence, but it's excellence of living in a society, in Aristotle's terms, is the most important point. And this is, of course, what Jesus taught also in his most basic teaching, which is that our capacity of humanity is to feed the poorest person. That's the road to human well-being. It's a counterintuitive idea, which is why it has to be emphasized repeatedly. And it is when the Pope talks about the globalization of indifference. Indifference to what? It's indifference to each other is the most fundamental aspect of this challenge. And so it is the biggest question of our generation, of how to confront this indifference in time, because we live in time and our time is different from every earlier generation. Every generation could do great damage to itself, but ours is the only generation in history till now that could literally wreck the planet for all species and for all the future. And we're doing that, actually. We're really doing that. That's what is surprising. So the question is how to break that indifference. And that's why I put the Sustainable Development Goals, in my own view, as so central, as perhaps the only tool we're going to have to get this right, because we don't have so many tools. Cooperation is extraordinarily fragile. Finding a way to reach the public in a time of moral indifference and insanely available media, where we're bombarded by bits so relentlessly that no message can get through, is really the biggest question. Now, for me, the Pope's example is fundamentally compelling, not only his message, of course, but when one sees how he's gripped the world imagination by the statements of basic decency, it shows how hungry we are for some guidance, for some moral guidance. This is our biggest hope. There is lurking powerfully a way to make the breakthrough. And of course, we need to be very accurate right now to do that. Bill Venley said very wonderfully that these barriers are of ignorance, selfishness, and group egoism. I find, of course, partly as a teacher, I look to the ignorance issue first, because I believe that knowledge is the most powerful single step forward. And I always also refer to what President Kennedy said in exactly that time when he was fighting for peace, together with Pope John the 23rd, in that remarkable year of 1963. He said something which to me also epitomizes the Sustainable Development Goals. He said, by defining our goal more clearly, by making it seem more manageable and less remote, we help all people to see it, to draw hope from it, and to move irresistibly toward it. That's a very important idea, I believe. The goals are first and foremost a way to help people to understand our situation on the planet. And they're also a way to show concretely a way forward. Because if we can help to overcome the abounding ignorance on these issues and show that there are solutions that are manageable, then I think what President Kennedy said is true, that people draw hope from that, and by drawing hope from it, can move irresistibly toward these shared goals. And so I view the SDGs most importantly as helping us to define what's important and to show what's achievable, to show that the first part of the president's statement, that we are the generation that holds in our hands the ability to end all forms of poverty, is a compelling offer to humanity that people will draw great hope from. And the hope can break through the indifference. It's part of our responsibility, by the way, to call out. It's part of the function of morality and of goals, by setting an agenda, also to praise those who pursue it, that's part of our responsibility, and also to call out those who don't. Because we have to take an active moral position. One of the aspects, maybe even alongside the globalization of indifference, is the globalization of cynicism. And cynicism is an idea that selfishness is inevitable, that short-sightedness is inevitable, that there's nothing that can be done. My profession is a profession of cynicism, not my personal profession. My professional life as an economist, unfortunately, economists are profoundly cynical. When they see something wrong happening, they say, well, that's human nature. When they see someone cheating, they actually say, I don't mean to make a moral judgment. They're just following their incentives. And what I'm saying is we have to make a moral judgment. And we have to say no to Wall Street if it's abusive, or to oil companies if they're not taking responsibility for the planet. It's not just for us to say the important things, but it also is for us to call out when that kind of responsible behavior is not being carried out. In fact, when the opposite. There is no right to selfishness, and there is no presumption that selfishness is inevitable or that antisocial behavior is just human nature, because the point is we're in this battle to do the right things, and we can do them. That's our choice, fundamentally. And the final point that I think is crucial for us that makes the Sustainable Development Goals essential is the last point that Bill Venley made, which is group egoism. When we overcome indifference and when we overcome cynicism, we still often grapple with remarkable divisions of us versus them. And I've seen it in the last couple of days, horrible articles written by very talented people in the United States about how wonderful the shale gas boom is, for example, because it's going to recreate American power. And if we can just stop it from happening elsewhere, then America can be number one again, and so forth. These are shameful positions, by the way, because they talk about our challenges as us versus them challenges. The message that the science is telling us overwhelmingly, that you heard from Dr. Ramanathan just a couple of minutes ago, is if ever there were a circumstance on this planet when we are all in it together, it is our generation's moment, because we have reached the planetary limits. We are so crowded, we are so much in each other's faces, we have pushed so hard on the physical environment that there is no us versus them time left on the planet. And so this egoism, group egoism, is passé. It must be. And so I want to close with what my friends here know is my favorite quotation of President Kennedy, just to close, because I think it is, from a point of view of our governments, extraordinarily important. When he was trying, together with Pope John the 23rd in 1963, to convince the world that it's possible to make peace between the two superpowers. And the cynics said, that's impossible on both sides. You can't make peace. There can't be a treaty. There can't be trust. And President Kennedy did something absolutely extraordinary that year. All his effort was convincing the Americans to believe in the possibility of peace, because he said our attitudes are even more important than theirs. Because if we don't understand that peace is possible, how can you make peace with the other? And his basic message was that the Soviet Union, the Russian people, they're human beings like us. They have the same goals, the same needs, and so there isn't any scope for this group egoism. And he made a wonderful statement that many of you know, that I think is a fitting statement for the Sustainable Development Goals as well, and you can hear how the words apply in the new context. He said, "So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and to the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal." And those are, for me, words that can resonate, and they are, I believe, the spirit of the Sustainable Development Goals. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jeff, for that wonderful statement. We've heard a lot of powerful things here from this panel, including our colleague who's with us on the phone line, Dr. Ramanathan. We have about 14 minutes until 5 o'clock for exchange for comments and questions from the audience. We did start quite delayed, so I'm not sure those of us who can stay a bit longer could feel free to do so we could continue the conversation. But I also understand it for those who might need to leave precisely at 5. But the floor is open. Who wants to go first? Yes. Oh, sorry. Yes, please. If you would introduce yourself. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to thank you for this great afternoon, for your insightful presentations. I was not... What did you say?
Oh,
okay.
Yes.
My name is Jeanne. I am from the Mission of Rwanda, the DPR. Okay, I didn't expect to hear this in my entire career at the UN. I've been here for a year, and I felt that I was in a church somewhere where I was listening to the priest preaching. But really, I did enjoy it. I heard so many good words that I was not expecting to hear this afternoon. And besides that, I feel that I'm still skeptical about all these things, because I don't believe that it can only happen in a utopic society. You know, for me, that's how I view things. You know, it's too good to be true. So I heard words like humanity, common good. Those words, they are all good, but I'm still skeptical on how, the means to use to implement all those words you're preaching. Because when you see what we see in our society, really, it is hard. But I loved what Professor Sachs mentioned, saying that we can even point fingers when we see that things are not working right. We have the right to do that. And if we can live in a society like that, where we are free to say what we feel, that maybe can change things. But drawing from the experience of my country, if I may talk about it, I believe in a society that is human-centered, where the word dignity, I heard the word dignity, you know, maybe you have to touch the bottom of the pit in order to know how important a human life is. To me, that is what I noticed in my country, when I see where we came from, what we went through, and how people understood that they have to help each other in recovering and coming back together as a society. So for me, I don't wish anybody to go through what we went through, but I think somehow some humanity can appear when you go through all those things. If the world could, I'm thinking of those who are better off, who are really fortunate, if they can think that what they own is not because of their own power, that they have those, if they can think that those people who are helping them to reach the level they have in their richness, they can think of others and share what they have. I think that is how I view things. If you see some employers who are exploiting their employees, they are rich. They don't think of those people who make them, who put them on the top of the pedestal. They don't think about those. So if people can realize, sit and think of what they are doing that is not right, maybe they can change and try to help humanity. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Let's hear from a couple of others as well. Please.
But I just want to say, you started by saying you didn't believe it, but then you explained why you do believe it.
Yeah. Please.
And thank you for these powerful words, as has been said. My name is Melanie Valencia. I'm a recent graduate at Columbia University. And I think the framework of the conversation of why we're doing this is very important, but to transfer that into the Sustainable Development Goals and with the focus of monitoring and evaluation that has surrounded the Millennium Development Goals, I'm curious to know how we're going to measure this why, because so much of what we have been measuring is specific things that do not necessarily represent what we're aiming for, and it is this joy, and it is this happiness, and it is this going away from ignorance. So I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on how to approach that. Thank you.
Please.
Hi, thank you so much, really, especially for the moral values bringing into the Sustainable Development Goals. And I agree that it is kind of first time heard of in terms of moral values incorporating with the Sustainable Development Goals. By the way, my name is Birjan Ünver, and I represent Late Millennium Organization, and we are associated with the DPI. My fundamental question and concern, which are kind of directly related to what has been said here, for instance, when we heard of from the scientists 3 billion people, and also last week there was a conference, 3.4 billion people don't have access to electricity. And I might confuse the reference, but really it was a very powerful statement, bottom up, and 3 billion people don't have access to electricity. That goes with the education, 3 billion, over 3 billion people don't know how to read or write. And that goes with many basic health and job and living. So the fundamental question is to tie in everything it's been said here, in, of course, moral values and sustainability. How and what are the mechanisms that will empower those bottom of 3 billion people that are not on the table? I couldn't hear that. I've seen, heard, listened so many important, crucial proposal, project, ideas, investment. Even the investment, let's say, to provide electricity for bottom up 3 billion in the form of business investment. But if that those people, those population are not power, how are they going to pay? So there are so many things that not on the table. Any question, any comments that how the Sustainable Development Goals will empower 3 billion people? Thank you. Bottom up.
Please.
Thank you very much. My name is Amigi. I'm with the Human Development Report Office. And my question is this. We've been working on the issue of poverty reduction, human development for a long time. And I'm just wondering whether there has to be a policy shift rather than addressing the conditions of poor people, focus more attention on the positions of poor people. By that, what I mean is giving the bottom 2 billion the voice and the space to negotiate on their own behalf. And how, as UN and especially UNDP, how can we take this upon ourselves to try to support anti-poverty movements at country levels for this to happen? Thank you very much.
And I represent United Methodist Women. I heard the ambassador mentioning the practical concerns of the very core human needs, and Dr. Venley mentioning holistic development, which is something we're really concerned about. My question is how can the SDGs connect these two things, provide for these basic human needs that are so crucial, but also addressing the cross-cutting concerns of women, of climate change, of peace, of human security, and how to connect those two things. Thank you.
Let's take one more, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all the presenters for your wonderful, your words, inspiring words. So my understanding of what we're discussing is that there's a scientific element and then there's a values-based element. And the science seems to be what we're referencing quite frequently in the SDGs, whether it's science of economics or climate change. And it's very important to do so. But my question is about the science of values. We've heard and we've all experienced the importance of treating your neighbor with with kindness and how it benefits society. And so I would propose that one of the elements of SDGs, or our own individual action, in fact, would be an enhanced study of the scientific, using the scientific method of the importance of values in our everyday lives. And that should be through our education systems as well, just as science is taught in all of our education systems, and we base our decisions upon both. Thank you.
Thank you. We have already quite a number of thoughts and ideas and questions on the table. I'm not sure who should I ask to go first. Bill, do you want to try to?
Well, I'll try the wonderful question that you raised about how measure the why. That's a tough question, and it's a terribly good question. I'm going to take a particular slant on it. The why question is why are we concerned about this? What is motivating us? What grounds us? And let me retreat back a little bit to the religious ground. I'm not sure if that's a retreat or a progress, but I think all of the religions basically deal in their own ways, and they're different, with what might be termed life questions. And variants of life questions are several. Where did I come from? What is the meaning of my existence? Does my life have meaning and purpose? Those are questions that occur not to people in one part of the earth, but to people all around the world, earth. And they could be stated somewhat philosophically. Does meaning have any meaning? Or does value have any value? And this, or is it simply arbitrary? Are we simply gambling here as people? The religions answer, and other traditions as well, answer affirmatively. That's a stunning thing. One doesn't force anybody to take that position. And they have their own ways to try to validate that. Those ways are secondary. If you're in love with somebody, people don't come up and ask you to prove that you're in love with somebody. And so if you're in love with how you understand your religion, the source of existence, the proof of that is a derivative, secondary attempt to make sense of it to yourself. It's not, people aren't usually persuaded by that. But what it shows in is that people find that they have a ground for being committed. And the way it really shows, and it was, Jeff, some of the things you were speaking get very close to this. People in all of the traditions, religious and other great moral traditions, realize that it's an intelligent thing to actually sacrifice. One gives up some things because there are other things more important than what you have given up. There are values that are arrayed in a hierarchy for you. This is important, but actually comparatively this is more important. And people commit themselves, and in ways very large and sometimes ordinary and quite small, they give up things because there are more important other things for them to be doing. Here we're facing, the way Jeff and others are facing it, the whole international community is facing it, there is something of ultimate concern. Are we going to go forward? Are we not going to go forward? And I think the measurements, if you would try to measure it, is are people committing themselves because those are their own values and they're willing to place other good things potentially at a lesser position in their lives? And I think one could begin to find intelligent ways to get people to understand and to report on their own respective scales of values. So I think there would be a possibility to do that. And yet, finally, it'll come back to the ground of people being convinced that meaning has meaning and that value has value. And that's, when you go there, you're moving into the domain that the religions have been reporting on since they've been around. Thank you.
Thank you. Jeff, would you like to comment?
Those are excellent questions. Also, I'm just going to take a couple of the points quickly. I don't think we've thought about how to measure the why. I think it's a great first time I've heard the question, so I think it's a wonderful question. One thing that I hope the Sustainable Development Goals has in it is a commitment, is a call for commitment to them, especially at an organizational level of governments and companies, because these are the two most powerful global scale organizations that organizational forms that play a role. And I'm especially interested in making sure that companies are parties to the commitment of good governance within the Sustainable Development Goals, especially because the global corporate sector is the most powerful sector in the world economy, obviously, but even in world politics, the companies I would put above the governments in too many cases. And so I want the government, the companies, to commit to the Sustainable Development Goals, and also for us to have the opportunity to hold them to account for those commitments. Again, I do believe that part of the mechanism, if I could call it that, of ethical equilibrium in society is not only the internal decision that this is what counts, but also the social commitment to defend what counts and to protest against the opposite. And when companies misbehave, we need to have a clear point to stand to say that's wrong and that's unacceptable. And I believe that we can make even the biggest, most powerful companies back down if there are clear standards of behavior. And this won't go, this won't be acceptable in the world going forward, because it's not ethical. It's not consistent with sustainable development. So this is one part of what I hope is incorporated into this. A second point I do want to make on a very practical level. When goals are set, like the Millennium Development Goals, it becomes crucial to do a lot of very practical problem solving. And when the goal was set to reduce maternal mortality by 3/4 or to reduce the incidence of malaria or AIDS, we then need expertise to say, how could such a goal be accomplished if the goal is universal access to safe energy? That requires some very practical approaches, especially for people who can't pay for it on their own, for example. This is clear. And so the goals become the occasion for absolutely practical, pragmatic programming. One of the things that comes into that programming is finance, because when you're dealing either with public goods or with the very poor people, the resource mobilization is a central issue of implementation. And that's why next year, in addition to the Sustainable Development Goals adoption in September, there will be an international conference on financing for sustainable development in Ethiopia next July. This is going to be a very important time for creating the basis for implementation. Nobody should be thinking that this is a matter of all goodwill suddenly somehow making difficult things possible. The goodwill makes it possible to think clearly about how to do the things that need to be done. And for that, we need the science, we need technology, we need finance. With the goodwill empowering all of that. So there should be plans at all scales, from local to international, to address those kinds of concerns. And on the question of how do you combine issues of women's empowerment, climate, and so forth, that's exactly why the Sustainable Development Goals should be seen as a package and as a narrative. And the Sustainable Development Goals should be stated in a way, in my opinion, that for the next 15 years at least, we are telling ourselves a story about what's important, and that it's an understandable story, and that the world can say this is a basis for humanity to move forward together. And it will have those things featured in it that you mentioned. So they won't be somehow apart. It will be the theme of the Sustainable Development Goals, that integrated or holistic framework, so that those important areas are highlighted. And we're trying, I believe, to create a narrative that is going to be fresh and important and motivational for the next 15 years.
Thank you. Bishop?
I want
Here you are.
First time, I think we are open, and we need to thank that to these other questions that in the past don't in the last past year don't want so present. For this, I think that
there we go.
That's kind of okay. And in this sense, we observe a real important change, and these are the change that change the history. If we are awareness of the problem and we try to put solutions, and for me it's a real change, and this change that is in this new generation, and to look to the future, and to look to the solidarity with the future generations is very important. It's clear that, for example, Pope Francis make a change in the line of the work of do in the church. And it's clear that there are president that has a special wisdom and can change things. But we need also to change, because today, with these new instruments and the new technology and the globalized world, the public opinion is very important. and the pressure to make the public opinion to the governments is decisive. And we have many, today, many movements to try just to put pressure in the government to look to the real important things. For this, we can change. The opinion public have a great importance to change things. And if you look to the future, for the young people have another mentality and are awareness that can change things. And we need to change also, not only the people, not only our mentality, but also the institutions. Because there are, and this is very important, there are structures, social structures that can go well, but there are others that don't go well. And we need to change these institutions because, as the same new generation of economists say, there are institutions that fail, that are not in the good way. And for this, we need to reinforce the international institution or the national institution. And this is a very important thing. And also to remove the corrupt institutions. And this is a very important task to arrive to have justice, global justice, and to have another society more just and more happy than the society that we have. Anyway, we need to recognize that in the history we have a great progress that came especially for science today, but not only for this, also for the people that are real moral. And in the end, we need to know that the real force that have the truth, the good, and the beautiful are more important than the other force. And in the end, we are completely in the understanding that these are the force to convene in the history. Thank you.
Thank you. There was a wonderful question about whether UNDP, and perhaps for that matter, the rest of the UN system and the development community couldn't do a better job in terms of connecting to and bringing the voices of the poorest and most vulnerable and most excluded. And I think that's a crucial point. I think at times, at our best, we have strived to do that and also sometimes managed to do that to a certain degree, but I agree that it's far from where it needs to be. But I do think in the process of this remarkable post-2015 discussion, we have tapped into something very powerful that we should leverage and do more of in the future. We brought 3 million voices of people all over the world into this process, and a large number of them are in fact on the margins, among the most vulnerable, among the those who are never before been heard. And I think there's an enormous potential in, so to speak, staying in touch with that constituency and growing it and making them feel that what happens here is somehow connected to their lives and that they have a voice. And I think if we do that, we create a direct link between the people for whom the values of the UN resonate the most and the deliberations of this body that has all the right norms but sometimes lack the mechanisms and the ability to connect the dots. And I think that is the way to go for the future. Do we have time for a couple more questions? I know you would like to come in and maybe another person, and then we close after that. Is that okay? Yes, please.
Thank you very much. I would just like to add a little bit to the discussion. I heard a lot about air pollution and carbon pollution, and thank you guys so much for your focus on solutions. I think that's really important. But when we're thinking about solutions and where do we jump in, how do we prioritize? And one of the things that we are thinking about, my name is Rachel Vineyard from the Global Alliance on Health and Pollution, by the way, sorry. And if we're looking at how do we want to protect children as a moral responsibility in the earth from all the environmental impacts that we are causing, can we think about a really large issue that hasn't really come to the table, which is the topic of pollution? We did hear on air pollution and carbon pollution, but there's a whole other realm that's just becoming kind of discovered, which is pollution from oil, pollution from soil, water, and those are things that we seem to have forgotten about on the international environmental agenda, and one thing that the Global Alliance on Health and Pollution is trying to promote. And so if we're just, from our position, we're just saying, if we're looking at how to make the most impact through sustainable development goals, let's look at where our priorities are in terms of impacts on human health and on the environment. And one thing that we would love to see considered is a topic of pollution as a whole, not just air pollution and carbon pollution. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. My name is Ronald, and I come from Zimbabwe, representing the Zimbabwe United Nations Association. My question was going to be directed to Excellency Mary Elizabeth Torres, and unfortunately, Amina is not there. One of the challenges we have had about the Millennium Development Goals is the issue of it being translated into local languages. So as a point of information, I just want to find out how it has been like in Honduras. Thank you.
Okay. One question about pollution and one question about making the goals understandable in all languages. I'm sorry, I do think we have to close after this. Who would like to tackle pollution? Jeff, can I ask you?
Yeah, thank you very much. I am sure that the issue of the pollutants will definitely be part of the indicators and targets, and so I look forward to discussing in more detail with the proposals that your alliance has made. As you noted, there's new recognition of much of this pollution. For example, the recent studies of soil pollution in China, which have come out just in the last month, which are quite striking. So I think there's a lot to follow up on, and I look forward to that.
Madam Flores?
Thank you very much for the question. It's especially important to us in Honduras, and as one of the member states of this organization, and in light of the responsibility that we have in terms of putting forth a compromise and a roadmap in terms of achieving a more sustainable future. I think that what you have said is very relevant, how we can create something here in terms of a document and in terms of commitments and aspirations in terms of what governments and leadership can do, but also how it reflects back on our population or generations that are going to be also responsible for shaping this future, and how we can put all of this information in terms of local languages. Well, it helps to have something that's understandable, that takes all the knowledge and all the understanding that we have available at the time, and then to make with it the right choices and the best decisions with the capacity that is available to us. For governments to be able, in a national level, to translate what this is to the people and the communities. And what I have found very interesting, because I was very engaged with the Millennium Development Goals and visiting schools, also health clinics, providing access to people to sanitation, to water, all these things that we did during this period, and we must continue, plus the new issues that we are dealing with, I could feel a great deal of difference in the community and how they could help and build into all of these aspirations in terms of their empowerment, their understanding of how they could make a difference, and how certain things are achievable, and there are many possibilities above and beyond the limits that they know in their localities. To be able to think beyond what they know, what they understand, and what has been traditionally in terms of what their parents had or what their grandparents left them in terms of the future, what they can see for their children. That makes a huge difference. And if we share in all of these responsibilities and we trust each other to move forward, I think that we will be building a better future. And I am positive. I am positive because I think that we cannot afford to be negative, mm-hmm. especially in terms of children. Children absorb a lot of what we adults say. And sometimes we push upon them a world that's not fair because we have a reality and they might have a reality that is much better than one we can ever believe in. So thank you very much to all of you for being part of this discussion. It's contributing into what I believe will be the promise of our future generations.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Bishop?
I want to add a word. We have in the academy and a workshop about brine and bread. And was very important, the conclusion, the statement, that it's very important the first 2 years for the children, and of course the alimentation of the mother, but also the alimentation of the children in the first year, especially because they have a develop of the brain 80%, and if don't have enough alimentation, he don't have a good develop, and remain with not too much interest to take his responsibility in the life and to develop his capabilities. This is a very interesting thing that I hope that could be a statement also for the Millennium Goals. Thank you.
Thank you for that. In fact, we have with us the special advisor in UNICEF for the post-2015 agenda, Nick, all the way in the back of the room there. And Nick and I were in the same meeting yesterday, and I learned something extraordinary there. You know, a normal grown-up, basically 20% of the energy from nutrition is used to basically keep the brain going, which is in and of itself extraordinary. Just 20% of everything you eat and consume is simply for the brain to keep working. Now, for a toddler, it's 85%. The toddler needs 85% of the food he consumes or she consumes simply to keep the brain from developing normally. So, of course, implications are enormous that if you're during that critical phase, well, from conception all the way through toddler age, if there is not enough food on the table, to put it that way, it has enormous consequences. And this is something we're starting to really understand with the science of brain development. So having this covered in the agenda, this is the bedrock, this is a starting point of equity. If we don't get it right in that phase, we will never get it right in a lifetime. It's that important. I really want to thank the panelists. You've done a fantastic job. Let's give them a hand. And equally to all of you who have spent this afternoon when the World Cup had its first match and everything, I don't know, engage in this discussion. And thanks to Ambassador Kourosi for being with us the whole time, the co-chair of the Open Working Group, deeply appreciated. We all know that as we get down to the wire, and there's tremendous efforts to try to focus in on a workable agenda, that's when the risk is the highest, that one will trade away the most precious things. And I think if anything, what we've heard today in terms of why we're doing what we're doing, the values at stake, maybe can be a small help in this process to, yes, absolutely focus the agenda and make sure we keep everything in it that really makes it worthwhile. And there's a lot on your shoulders, co-chair, but there's also a big, big community looking at this process and cheering you along and wishing you the very best. But thank you. Thank you for being here.